You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. The conflict in Afghanistan is often referred to as America's forgotten war. 15 years after 9/11, what is the country's status and the United States' responsibility to it? FSI's Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law hosts a discussion with General Carl Eikenberry, an FSI scholar who formerly served as the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, and Eric Jensen, co-director of the Rule of Law program at Stanford Law School. The discussion follows.
Thank you all for coming. One of the joys of teaching at Stanford and being at FSI in particular are the terrific colleagues that you have, who are obviously really smart and have done great things. They don't really need much of an introduction, just to say that their experience in Afghanistan is really, incredible. Carl served both as head of Allied Forces, coalition forces in Afghanistan, also served as a U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. Eric, in his role both for the Asia Foundation and for the law school, has had a lot of involvement in Afghanistan and was central in creating the American University in Kabul. They both went, this was at the end of November, in early December when you were there?
I was there in October.
In October.
And December.
October and December. And they decided that this would be a good time to step back and talk about where we are in Afghanistan, where Afghanistan is, and what U.S. policy options might be under the administration. So take a look at that.
Thank you, Steve. Thank all of you for coming. Eric and I, we did get together. I was in Afghanistan in October for about a week, and it was a very profitable, be careful with the word using profitable. it was a very productive week. I had an opportunity when President Ghani had found out I was in Kabul. He invited me just to live at the palace. That proved to be very useful because it's hard to get around Kabul, and all Afghans want to come to the palace, so rather than me having to summon them to the Serena Hotel, so to speak, or waste a lot of time on the road, I was just able, from the sun came up until late at night, to have endless meetings there. So very, very, very helpful, and I know Eric, every one of his trips gets deep into society. We had started this off, though, back in November when Eric came back and said, let's just do a real casual brown bag lunch and talk a little bit. And then we checked and the numbers were up, and then I realized that lunch had been offered, and I realized why we have such this kind of attendance here. A couple of points as we get started here. So why is it useful for us to be talking about Afghanistan? Well, it's been more than 15 years since 9/11, since we began our intervention into Afghanistan. It's the longest war, as everyone knows, in American history. To date, we've had 2,386 American soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and civilians killed in the line of duty in Afghanistan, over 20,000 wounded in action, and of that 20,000, many of those numbers, some of those numbers, are going to be living lives like we couldn't imagine for the rest of their lives. Cost $750 billion to date in war in Afghanistan. $43.7 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money devoted to Afghanistan this year. Longer-term costs, we think, primarily the buildup of health care costs over time. We expect this war 20 to 25 years from now, total tab would be about 1.5 to 2 trillion U.S. dollars. Trillion U.S. dollars. It's the major combat operation that America has today. Iraq is second. Iraq has 5,000 U.S. troops. In Afghanistan, we have 8,400. We also, of course, have a presidential transition that's underway in our country. There's also, in that part of the world, I think it's fair to say, looking at China, Russia, India, the major actors around Afghanistan, there's geopolitical transitions that are underway right now. With all of that, Eric and I thought it would be a good time to have this session. So What we have planned here is the two of us working together, hopefully with a seamless transition between us. We'd like to talk very briefly about the road America and the world has traveled since 9/11 in Afghanistan. Talk a little bit about the conditions in Afghanistan today. And then perhaps more interesting for this group, some assessments and reflections on the war, lessons learned for the United States, and then finally policy options. So with that, and then question and discussion at the end. So with that, we'll start with the road traveled after 9/11. And very briefly, so as we know, after 9/11, the United States of America, under President Bush, Bush administration, commit to trying to get Osama bin Laden extradited. Taliban regime refuses, and America then conducts a military intervention, the goal to destroy al-Qaeda and to topple the Taliban regime. For a period of time, from about 2001 to 2004, there's a relatively light military footprint. We're talking numbers of about 15,000 at that point. There's a consensus among the Afghans, the international community, and the Americans that time is generally on our side. We need to find bin Laden. We suspect he's over in Pakistan. There's a low-grade insurgency starting to develop, and we're putting some efforts into the development of the economy and the governance, but generally the assumption is that it will be hard for Afghanistan to develop over time, but there's no real serious threat to those efforts. Then from 2005 to 2008, it's becoming very evident that there is a now world-class insurgency starting to develop with sanctuary in Pakistan, but inside of Afghanistan. Efforts to build governance are not gaining traction. Efforts to build an Afghan national army and police force that can deal with that growing insurgency threat, always a couple of about a year or two behind, because we're always underestimating the threat that that security force has to be prepared to deal with. And so things are deteriorating. The Bush administration recognizes this, but there is not a lot the Bush administration can do at this point because they're consumed by the war in Iraq. 2009 to 2011, we have candidate Barack Obama go on the campaign trail, says that Iraq was the war of choice and it was a bad choice. Afghanistan was the war of necessity and it was under-resourced. He comes into office in 2009 to do something about this, and he conducts a very thorough review, decides to heavily reinforce our military mission, takes our troop levels up to about 100,000, a lot more effort put into developing governance, but he also puts a time limit on this effort. It will be culminated in 2011 in the summer. He adheres to that. And then we begin a transition of 2012 to 2014 where our military force levels come down, our development assistance efforts come down, our embassy and diplomatic mission shrinks in size, and the goal is by the end of 2014 for Afghanistan now to have reclaimed its de facto sovereignty. It has de jure sovereignty beginning with the establishment of the government in 2004. But it does not have de facto sovereignty, and how could it, as America and our allies are conducting military operations, as one example in Afghanistan, up till 2014, where we then conduct a raid and take Afghan citizens and move them under our control to Bagram Air Base. So the ideas of parallel governments that exist with our provincial reconstruction teams, pieces that we have in place that are degrading efforts of the Afghans to take control, all of that changes by 2014. An agreement is reached between the Obama administration and the Karzai administration to have a long-term bilateral security agreement. And finally, in 2015, Afghanistan has the full transition to their sovereignty. Now, during this period of time, the threats will change. As I said, we start off low-grade insurgency, go to a much higher grade, a much more virulent insurgency, introduction of ISIS, and all of the time then for the Americans and indeed the international community dealing with these threats, time mounting, expectations being lowered, President Obama clearly moves in a direction from always skeptical about state building, but clearly after about a year of disappointing results from 2009 to early 2011 shifts, and the expression about Afghan good enough governance starts to take hold. So a military-focused mission, some development and governance goals, but much more modest than if we go back even to the era of 2002-2003. To sum up here then, just to take a look at troop levels as showing levels of effort from 2001, I talked about that very light footprint period of time. These are years 2001 to 16. These are numbers of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. It doesn't show the considerable NATO allied presence fighting along with U.S. forces. But you can see we start off with a very light footprint, under 20,000. It's not till 2006 that we go over 20,000. Here's President Obama's surge years. He wants to bring those numbers back to a very minimal presence by 2016, just a small group of soldiers at an embassy doing traditional security assistance mission, but conditions begin to change here where Taliban showing more strength in the field, and especially ISIS starting to gain ground in Afghanistan, where he's getting best military advice from some of his national security community, saying, Mr. President, I know your goal was to leave office and that to be about 100 troops right there. Not possible. He takes this on board. I think he compares the withdrawal from Iraq. I think he would conclude, in fairness, it was too fast, and thought that the glide slope here should be now looking more like this. So at this point in time, we've got about 8,400 troops in Afghanistan. And lastly, here's to just show levels of effort. Here is our aid and development that we're putting into Afghanistan from the year of 2002 to 2015. Dark part of the bars each year is security. Light part is economic and governance assistance. You can see it's very dominated, though, by the military assistance program. And this is showing in billions of dollars and percentages of GDP. So with that, then, as background, we'll turn and talk a little about the so-called state of the state. How is Afghanistan doing in terms of security, politics and governance, its economy, and then looking a little bit around the region. So first of all, what's the state of the insurgency? But the insurgency is not only a Taliban insurgency, but you have a growing presence of the Islamic State of Khorasan, as they call it, inside of Afghanistan. So there's the map of Afghanistan. If you're looking at orange, that's not good. That's Taliban. If you're looking at black, that's not good. That's ISIS. And then you have combinations of both. Where you can see is, first of all, starting with ISIS, primarily in the east. That's historically been a very difficult area for Afghan security. That's an area in which bin Laden in the 1980s operated in when he was there fighting the Soviets with some of his Arab brothers. And then you see the areas of Taliban control, strong control in the south, especially in Helmand province, but pockets in northern Afghanistan that have developed over time, not entirely, but in the main, in those pockets, what you will find are Pashtun minority populations that are feeling oppressed by non-Pashtun majority populations. Those could be Tajik, those in some instances are Hazara, those are Uzbeks. The Pashtun, then, oriented Taliban come into those areas. They can appeal to the grievances of those Pashtuns. More complicated than this in many instances. There's criminal factors at work here. But the spread of the Taliban insurgency then into northern Afghanistan has been a development that we began to see in 2009, but it's become worse with the withdrawal of U.S. and allied forces. To give you some quick numbers here, so on security, 63% of the districts of Afghanistan, the territory of Afghanistan, is now firmly under government control. That's down from 72% just last year. And that 63%, it roughly does correspond to about two-thirds of the population. There's 470 districts in Afghanistan. A district in Afghanistan is like a county in the United States. 407 districts in 34 provinces, 258 under government control, 86 under government influence, 35 are under insurgent control or influence, and there's 116 districts inside of Afghanistan right now which are contested. Another worrisome development is that the Taliban's command and control, which enjoyed sanctuary in Pakistan, doesn't enjoy as much sanctuary in Pakistan now because the Pakistan government, my own view, maybe too cynical, is that encouraging them to move out of their territory. And now that you don't have the U.S. military presence and our NATO military presence, where you have the ability to find anybody on the Afghan side of the border with good intelligence and strike, the Afghans and we don't have that capability anymore. So you're seeing more of the Afghan commanded, Taliban command and control that's moving inside of Afghanistan. Poppy production. If it's bright red on this map, that's not good. If it's lighter shades, that means strong increase over last year, 2015-2016. Opium poppy cultivation change over this past year. Bright red means a very strong increase, over 40%, and then you drop down to the white, which is poppy free. Not a lot of areas. But it's estimated that poppy production, if you take it through its chain of production, that that equals now about 7.4% of the total GDP of Afghanistan. It's a huge number. And we've seen an increase in poppy production of 2016, just this past year, from the previous year, a rise of about 10%. A significant amount of Taliban funding comes from protection of poppy trade, you think FARC in its early days, but also, I think, worse for the Afghan people is the absolute corruption of the government and the security forces that occurs here. So who knows, rough estimates being given by groups like DEA and intelligence, but maybe about a third of the money for the poppy trade might be going to the Taliban. About two-thirds of it is going to the Afghan National Police and Afghan politicians. And a final point about security in terms of perception of the Afghan people. So this is from the Asia Foundation survey of the Afghan people, which I think, Eric, goes back to 2004. Every year, 2006 is the first year. So every year, the Asia Foundation conducts a pretty good survey of the Afghan people, ask a wide range of questions. It's the Gallup poll all crammed into one survey. And the methodology they have is extraordinarily credible. If you look at the results each year, very consistent, and it matches then what you'd anticipate in terms of shocks to the system. So here we are in 2006, we go up to 2016. Question for the Afghan people in this survey, would you fear for your own personal safety or security or for that of your family these days? 2006, well before the surge, 40%. It actually paradoxically increases during the surge, comes down a little bit, but now we're at 70%. That's a dramatic change. Afghan National Security Forces, a few words about them, three categories. That's the Afghan National Army, authorized strength, 195,000. We have an Afghan National Police Force, 157,000 authorized strength. And finally, the National Directorate of Security, think a combined CIA, FBI, with a counterterrorist strike force. So those are the authorized strength. Of those altogether, we American taxpayers have put about $45 billion since 2002 into this enterprise. So how are they doing? First of all, they're having problems with attrition, desertion, retention. So the Afghan National Army, looking at the authorized number up there, they have about 170,000 right now. The Afghan National Police have about 148,000. The National Director of Security continues to do very well. trained by the CIA. Very high casualty rates for the Afghan National Security Forces. In this past year, they had, just for the first 8 months, they had 15,000 casualties, of which were 5,500 killed in action. We think by the end of this year, we don't know for a while, but the numbers for the Afghans now, not giving numbers, the numbers are probably 18,000 to 20,000 casualties this past year, of which there were 6,000 killed in action. So think about those numbers. Remember, Afghanistan's population, a little over 30 million, so make that U.S. rates of casualties. That would be the equivalent of 60,000 killed in action in the United States Armed Forces in this past year. Probably an unsustainable rate for the Afghans. I mentioned attrition rates are higher than are high right now. They're higher than the replacement rates, slightly. The back and forth, it's always people worried the numbers are coming down, they're stabilizing. But at any rate, they have attrition rates right now of about one-third per year, about 33% a year. Why that is something to keep an eye on, not only are total numbers coming down, but the more churn you have, the less effective your forces are. You need to retain soldiers and police for several years before they gain enough competence to perform well. Huge supply and corruption problems within the force. Ghost soldiers and ghost policemen, the commander of the Helmand Province Police blurted out, probably unintentionally, this summer at a press conference that he thinks about half of his police force are actually ghost policemen. That is, the United States, the international community, paying the Helmand Province, or actually the Ministry of the Interior in Kabul, a lot of money, but that money is not actually translating to salaries for soldiers and policemen. Improvements being made, electronic payments being made. I become skeptical over time of those from a distance. That's the solution. It's electronic payments. Believe me, when you're sitting out in Helmand Province, far, far from Kabul, people are clever enough to figure out in the chain of command how to take that electronic money wherever it's going to and make sure it gets into their pocket. Leadership concerns. Something that I worried over several things. Eric will talk about a few of those, such as the migrants. So I won't mention that. In Afghanistan, though, for the first time, I heard a lot of the political elite showing a loss of confidence in the Afghan army leadership. We had worked very hard until about 2011 at the peak of the surge. I mean, you have a lot of numbers on the ground. There are coaches and referees everywhere so you can watch. But as that got pulled back, that ability to do that started to evaporate, and you're hearing more and more now complaints about senior army commanders and police commanders going to place that got there on a bribe or got there under political patronage, not on performance. The strategy of the Afghan National Security Forces now is with General Mick Nicholson, our four-star commander of our NATO force and our American Army forces, American military forces on the ground, working with them. They've shifted from when we pulled back in 2014. Of course, if you're a political leader in Afghanistan, you want to hold on to every district. It's a sign of weakness, and you're going to hurt yourself politically if you say we're going to have to pull back. So this desire to hold everywhere. They are shifting from that strategy to what they call a hold and fight strategy. You take your critical cities and you take your supply lines, the Ring Road is an example, your major highways, lines of communication, and then you consolidate your military forces and give a priority to either defend those or if the enemy contests those, you fight to get it back again. Now, that takes with it a risk as well, because in the countryside then, the Taliban is able to secure more territory. The final point I'd like to make about the Afghan National Army that is also a bit worrisome here, and that is that although I showed you numbers of Afghan National Army of 170,000, that the real combat power of the Afghan National Army is in their special operations forces. It's in an elite group of special forces that are very well trained by our forces and, importantly, enabled by our forces. So our special forces get with their special forces they go and conduct a combat mission. They have the ability to call in U.S. air power. They've got the ability to call in surveillance of the enemy. And it's those small number of forces that are able to push back Taliban wherever they need them. But the main force, the main infantry forces, are very static. They're not as well trained. When you talk about the attrition problems, it's with them. And so this special forces of Afghanistan, which has been the silver bullet for about the last 3 years, we're starting to see them degrade. Not in terms of desertions, it's a high morale group. They're just getting banged up. Their equipment's getting banged up and they're taking casualties. It's something, if we had time, maybe another topic, another subject for discussion one day. But if you look at how we are doing with these efforts to build big military forces like in Iraq or Afghanistan, what you're seeing is consistently the reliable forces are those elite forces that the backbone is us, but if they don't have our backbone, they're going to fall apart too. Look at Iraq. When you see, read the bylines in Iraq about the advance on Mosul, what you'll frequently see, it was Iraqi special forces that pushed back ISIS in this last fight, enabled by our special forces as well. And last point here is once again on the Asia Foundation survey. This was worrisome as well. Question from 2007 to 2016, this is the percentage of the respondents. Question, who thinks the Afghan National Police Force is honest and fair? About 45%. It's hanging in there until transition, and our teams are starting to disappear. That kind of mentoring, coaching, overwatch, referees, umpires, they're starting to draw down. And look what happens now to the ratings of the Afghan National Police. But people would say, well, the Afghan National Police have never been that highly respected within Afghanistan, but the Afghan National Army is. But then you look at the Afghan National Army as well, with a lot of coaching and mentoring, getting better and better, and transition point, highly respected, and then you've got a problem as we start to pull out. Finally, our U.S. and NATO military missions. We've got four tasks right now for the forces that are on the ground, about 8,400, and we've got complementing us about 5,000 other NATO and partner troops. But the counter-terrorist mission, a small group of special forces. The main effort is security assistance, coaching and mentoring, and helping the Afghan National Army Police learn to use their equipment and help train them. Support for other agencies, that's another way of saying our military support of the CIA to help them with their intelligence gathering and paramilitary operations. And then finally, combat support for not only our forces, but rules of engagement having been changed by President Obama as part of the shifting over the last year and a half, where he's giving our forces on the ground much more authority now. If they're not always if they're in a fight, they have those authorities. But being commanders on the ground now, being able to have more flexibility and determination that this is an operation that's underway right now that the Afghan National Army or police have to win or they cannot lose. And our commanders having much more discretion than to commit our own special forces and our own air forces and Army air forces in order to deal with those problems. So I'll shift then to you.
Just as a footnote to what Carl has laid out here, I had the opportunity when I was in Afghanistan in May to have dinner with General Mick Nicholson in charge of the Afghan forces. And he laid out in a PowerPoint presentation in a way that I think only the military can, to complicate the story more, eight different distinct factions or groups that are currently engaged in terrorist activity in Afghanistan. And that has implications for reconciliation, which Carl will be talking about soon. So, to continue the bad news, the economic growth, you see came from a high point of 11.3%. Actually, it had some good years of growth leading up to 2012, to 3.9% in 2013, to 0.8%. That's not 8%, that's 0.8%, sorry, in 2015. Projected for 2016 is 1.2%, and projected for 2017, inshallah, if everything goes well, a very modest 1.8%. Now, if we were talking about the U.S. economy, it would be a different story. But the this is growth off of an extremely low base. Revenue collection has actually increased. It's one of the few modest good stories to tell. In 2015, it was up to 10.2%, and historically, it had been below that, 9% and below. Debt is 1.7% of GDP, and a big, big number here is unemployment at 40%. I thought I'd insert a slide. It doesn't exactly fit in the presentation, but it's been an onslaught of bad news. And there is some modest good news. I'll get around to education later. But under five mortality rates are down significantly. Infant mortality rates down significantly. Maternal mortality rates down really significantly. Unfortunately, child malnutrition is, if it's not the highest, it's one of the two highest countries in the world. But there are some data, and I'll get into a little bit of the education data later. There's just a little bit of hope in this picture. Foreign assistance. 70% of the national budget comes from international donors. 42% of those funds go to defense. $15 billion has been spent on civilian assistance since 2002. $15 billion was pledged by international donors at the Brussels conference in October 2016, and that's down just $1 billion from the Tokyo pledge in 2012. For those of you who know Ashraf Ghani, you know that he's written this book, Fixing Failed States. And one of the Ashraf's central arguments is we need more on-budget support. There's too much funding that's off-budget that's going directly from donors to different groups in the country that we have no idea about. So 50% of the budget now is on-budget support. That is, donors give funding to the government of Afghanistan to disperse, and that's up a lot. It's up 100% from what the picture was in 2002. So, I think Carl, you were going to talk about the National Unity Government.
Yeah, let me. I'll just leave that slide up there. So on the, if we shift and talk a little bit about politics now, and or maybe you could, maybe we do have a slide of, okay. Talk a little bit about the politics in the country very briefly. So I think most know that the first peaceful transition of political power ever to occur in Afghanistan did occur, looking to what Eric has said about some good news, in 2014, but it was a difficult, very challenging process. So in June 2014, there was, in the post-Karzai era, a runoff conducted between President Hamid Karzai and Dr. Ashraf Ghani and Dr. Abdullah. The results of that runoff election were bitterly contested. There was a huge amount of fraud on both sides. And as a result of that, John Kerry had to fly into Kabul on several occasions and finally broker an agreement between Ghani and Abdullah and created the National Unity Government. So going outside of the constitution of Afghanistan, then Ghani becomes the president in a new position, which is called CEO, Chief Executive Officer. That is Dr. Abdullah's position. It's not the constitution. It was just a brokered agreement. Think about a prime minister. Both of them, however, did not have strong control over their factions that supported them. These were a very fractious group of people, bands of people that supported each. So although you have the National Unity Government, their ability then to implement the terms of the agreement, which is over the next 2 years, the terms of the agreement were over the next 2 years, decisions will get made, and then we'll transition away from the CEO model, and maybe we'll create a prime minister, but we'll do something that is grounded in the Constitution. Constitutional changes will be required. They haven't gotten to that point, so they continue then to have a very difficult time in Afghanistan trying to bring coherence to their government. So whether it's selection for ministries, and the money ministries count the most here, and the power ministries, not electrical power, but Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Defense, those positions really matter. Very difficult times, time trying to get an agreement on political appointments and getting laws passed through. The problems are mounting for both Ghani and for Abdullah. Ghani's vice, one of his senior vice presidents, Rashid Dostum, Uzbek commander, he has done a lot of horrible things. He's a war criminal. And now he has just assaulted another Uzbek leader violently, and so Ghani's trying to figure out what to do with his vice president. Abdullah on the other hand, he's having a very difficult time holding his group together because they view him as weak, not able to deliver, and there's a big challenge he's facing from a governor in northern Afghanistan, Atta, who's challenging him. So politics remain very complex. Final point about Ashraf Ghani, 2 points. One is that he's surrounded by a group of many expatriate Afghan Americans who are extraordinarily talented, but their ability to deliver good political advice to President Ghani, I think, is limited. And so the danger of isolation of President Ghani inside of the palace. A second problem that I'm very sympathetic with President Ghani on. So the United States, John Kerry arrives in 2014, says you got to have this national unity government. There's no question that Ashraf Ghani believes he won the election. There was fraud involved, he recognizes that, but he truly believes he won the election, says Abdullah. And so Ghani then...
So that's Thomas.
We should send him there to mediate. Credibility. So the problem that we have now, that we, the United States, we're seeing by Ashraf and his team, understandably, at having imposed this national unity government on him and Afghanistan, outside of the Constitution. And so then, as things continue to go wrong in Afghanistan, problems with corruption, problems with Afghan army commanders needing to be relieved who aren't relieved, we then talk to President Ghani about that. Why aren't you moving forward on reform programs? And Ghani's saying, because of this, the National Unity Government has done this to me. Now, if you're talking to those in the American foreign policy community or the National Security Council have been through this period of time, if Peter LaVoy was sitting here right now, he would say, you got part of that right, Carl, but let me tell you, about page two. All I'm giving you is what is in the mind right now, I think, of Ashraf Ghani and his advisors, and at least in my case, there's a period of sympathy with this.
Just to build off of that for a moment before going into the next section, this whole idea of constitutionalism, let's be clear that the Constitution is not viewed as a sacred document in Afghanistan. I won't in this presentation, but I could regale you with nine areas, large areas in which there is not compliance with the constitution of Afghanistan. All members of the lower house and one-third of the appointed senators have stayed beyond their term. The parliament is, in a sense, extra-constitutional as well in the way it's operating. More citizen perceptions as we talk about politics here, and this also comes from the survey of the Afghan people that is conducted by the Asia Foundation. You see the mood is down, distinctly down, from a high point of 58% to 2016, where it is 29%. Likewise, a fairly rapid rise, especially from 2014 to 2016, in views that 66% say the country is going in the wrong direction. Among urban women, the view is more dreary than among rural women. I don't think that's because rural women have a better lot in life. I think it's because urban women are better educated and greater access to information. Here are the top reasons for pessimism. Insecurity, which is very consistent with everything that Carl presented to you. Unemployment at 40%, it should be an acute concern. Corruption, a bad economy, and bad government and suicide attacks. But you see, insecurity, unemployment, and corruption are relatively large ticket items. Insecurity being by far the greatest. The satisfaction with government performance has declined in predictable ways. It's good to look at 2012 and 2016, I think, on this chart to see the precipitous decline of satisfaction with government performance. Satisfaction with democracy in aggregate, unsurprisingly, is also down from 77% in 2006 to 56% today. Refugees. 2015 was a huge year for out-migration and attempts to seek asylum in Europe. Before the Brussels conference in October of last year, the EU met with representatives of the government of Afghanistan and negotiated a deal where the EU can return an unlimited number of refugees. Seeking asylum, and this could be up to 80,000 people currently seeking asylum in Europe. There is a good side to this, and that is that these restrictive policies have led to reverse brain drain. Capable people are now coming back to Afghanistan. Both from Europe and Pakistan just unceremoniously kicked out a couple million Afghan refugees. Many of these people are educated and able, and I would look to them to be major contributors to the economy in the years to come. And the desire to leave has fallen with the concomitant inability to get asylum. So word has gotten out in Afghanistan that obtaining asylum is very difficult, and the route to immigration and naturalization is very difficult. So in rural areas, it's down from 38% to 28%, and in urban areas from 45% to 35%. But I think, again, the background variable is the realizing the reduced ability to leave.
So shifting to reconciliation in Pakistan, on the question of reconciliation being trying to get a political solution inside of Afghanistan, where the Taliban come back and negotiate with the legitimate government of Afghanistan and find a peace settlement. That's proved problematic over the years. When the United States first went in 2002, we and most of the international community thought Taliban had been defeated and had gone away. We really don't even start thinking about reconciliation in a serious way until maybe 2005, but it's not until about 2010 that the United States starts to actually develop a reconciliation program. But at the same time that we're trying to develop a reconciliation program, we have the Norwegians that have their initiative, the Germans have theirs, the Afghans have theirs, the United Nations has theirs, and most recently entering the process is China and Russia. So it's a real cottage industry that's out there. There's was some progress, maybe the most progress being made, I believe, was probably in the spring of 2016. Pakistan showing a willingness to start to encourage a viable process. But in May of 2016, Mullah Mansour, who was the head of the Taliban, had succeeded Mullah Omar, who was killed in a predator strike on Pakistan territory and eliminated. I am not of the school that believes that if he had not been killed, that reconciliation would have been achieved. There would have been other factors that would have prevented that. Nevertheless, you can say that's an inflection point. Since that point, we have not seen any kind of demonstrable progress. Just most recently, here at the end of this year, the Taliban announced that it was rejecting talks until foreign forces are leaving the country. It will leave the country permanently. However, the Taliban leadership is quite divided. And even under the best of circumstances, trying to get them to come to the table as a united force is problematic, made even more problematic by the fact that in the security situation, the Taliban's not doing bad in the field. And so when you've got momentum and you are then contemplating, should we come to the table and negotiate, generally, if you've got battlefield momentum and think you can keep it going, it's not time to come to the negotiating table. So this is difficult. Last point on survey of the Afghan people, directly related to the theme of this talk, but something I think you find very interesting. So what's this chart? 0 to 90% responding to 100%, 2009 to 2016. Here's the question. Thinking about these reasons why armed opposition groups, read Taliban, have been fighting during the past year in general, you say that you have a lot of sympathy, a little sympathy, or no sympathy at all for these armed opposition groups. No sympathy goes from 36% in 2009, comes up during the surge years, and then goes way up to 77%. A little sympathy, 34%. It actually comes back up during the surge years, but after the foreign forces start to leave Afghanistan, at this point in time, those numbers come up, these numbers come down. Something to think about, because one of the arguments about the surge was that if you put more surge forces, more foreign forces around the country, you will get Taliban recruits, because no matter how well you try to perform, many people in the country, especially in the rural areas, will look at this as an army of occupation. Or another way of looking at this, here's what the Afghan people answer the question, in your opinion. What is the main reason the armed opposition groups are fighting against Afghanistan? Open-ended question, first response recorded only. So to gain power, here, that was at 18% in 2011. You're at the peak of the surge. And coming up as foreign forces are leaving, presence of foreign troops in the international community, 2011, it's at 21%. When you've got a lot of foreign troops there, it's come down to 12%. So some people say this is actually a vulnerability of the Taliban. If the United States and the foreign forces can keep their numbers minimal, that a huge, huge attractive part of the Taliban narrative has been eliminated.
What's going on for you, Pakistan?
Okay. So now we... we come to Pakistan for just a minute. For those of you who know that I have a great deal of affection for the people of Pakistan, and I did a lot of work with the government of Pakistan when I lived there for 6 years. So I say what I'm about to say with a level of pain but some agreement. If you ask many Pakistanis, many Afghans would argue that the war is in Afghanistan, but it is with Pakistan. President Ghani's first year in office was a study in trying to achieve rapprochement with Pakistan. He was doing a brilliant job of it. He went and met with the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Pakistan, with Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif said, any enemy of Afghanistan is an enemy of Pakistan. It all looked good on a political level. And indeed, I think it could be good on a political level. I'll get to that. When President Ghani was in Amritsar, India, in early December for the Heart of Asia conference, he rejected $500 million in assistance that Pakistan had pledged at the Brussels conference. Afghanistan has never rejected any donor funding in the last 15 years. It rejected $500 million from Pakistan. And it was very intentionally done, I think, while he was in India. And Ghani said, if we are allowed to live peacefully, we can find $500 million. And if there is peace for 5 years, we would be in a situation to give $500 million. Sartaj Aziz, the sort of de facto foreign minister of Pakistan, he's a wise old man that I've known for years, said these are baseless allegations. It's simplistic to blame only one country for the recent upsurge in violence. We need to take a holistic view. Well, one part of that holistic view is that the Quetta Shura is the seat of government for the Afghan Taliban operations. That's where all of the senior Taliban hang out, is in Baluchistan, Pakistan, in Quetta Shura. It is also documented that the Haqqani network, which has been a conduit for the military through ISI, do bad things across the border, and they've been doing this for a long time, and that Haqqani network is flourishing. So I would say a holistic view would point to a lot of problems in Pakistan. Now, if you put Sartaj Aziz, and Nawaz Sharif, President Ghani, CEO Abdullah Abdullah in a room together, could they achieve an agreement? Yes, I think they could. But the problem is that the political side in Pakistan is not in control of, it's not calling the shots on the Quetta Shura, it's not calling the shots on the Haqqani network. And I think we know who's doing that. Okay, so now we're at assessment and reflections. We've gone on way too long and we're going to have to speed up. Just generally, this is something that that was written by Bruce Jones and company for the 2011 World Development Report on Development and Conflict Affected States. Creating the legitimate institutions that can prevent repeated violence is, in plain language, slow. It takes a generation. Even the fastest transforming countries have taken between 15 and 30 years to raise their institutional performance from that of a fragile state to that of a well-functioning institutionalized state. The really good news here is that we might be halfway to 30 years, and maybe in 30 years we can achieve that. SIGAR Inspector General John Sopko, who is a rather controversial figure, gave an assessment a couple of days ago, a general assessment that I think is pretty much how many of us who work on the ground in Afghanistan feel. I first witnessed the U.S. put in way too much, way too fast. More recently, I've watched the U.S. remove way too much, way too fast. And I think that this overall general assessment is really what many of us who care about responsible spending of development assistance would say. Just very briefly on the education example, again, to assess some progress in health and education, there were no girls attending formal schools back in 2001. And boys enrollment was about 1 million people. Net enrollment was low. The number of teachers was low. The number of university students was low. Enrollment increased since 2002 from 1 million to 8.7 million, 36% female. The number of teachers has risen. The quality of the teachers, there is still a lot to do. The numbers of university students have risen. But there are many, many girls going to school today in Afghanistan who never would have gone but for the intervention. And I could talk more about the assessment, but I think and reflections, but we can get into that later.
Yeah, why don't we just come on to policy options then to close it out here, if that makes sense.
Good.
So on the policy options then that this incoming administration is looking at right now, well, the starting point is what is the interest of the United States in Afghanistan? Great debate about that. Clearly, keeping Afghanistan from pre-9/11 is a key consideration, and it's a consideration that we have to think about right now. Al-Qaeda is coming back into Afghanistan. You also have got ISIS inside of Afghanistan itself. And then there's the symbolic importance of Afghanistan for international jihad. So the international jihadist myth that international jihad gets its first victory against the Soviets in the 1980s, and the myth then, can they also then take down another superpower in Afghanistan in the 21st century? The second consideration is the geopolitical consideration in Afghanistan, and that is that you do have a nuclear-armed Pakistan that sits to the east and the south. You have an Iran to the west. You have a problematic Russia to the north. You have Chinese interests that are expanding into Afghanistan today. So is there an argument to be made that just geopolitically that Afghanistan could actually be a partner? Well, after all that bad news we seem to deliver, you conclude perhaps no, but then you look around the region for options, and that might be a serious debate that takes place inside of the Pentagon. A third factor is economic interest. Here, maybe 25 years from now, there could be economic interest there, but the economic interest that people are looking at right now inside of Afghanistan, beyond the illicit drug trade, is the possibility of mineral natural resource extraction. It's considerable, but the United States of America does not have the economic capacity that we used to have to be thinking hard about going in there for energy or for coal or for copper. The Indians have that capability, the Chinese have that capability, but not the U.S. There's also a final point to be made about the moral obligations that from 2001-2002 we were telling the Afghan people, Afghan women, that we're here to see this through, till this enterprise succeeds, and you do have to consider the moral factors as well. What are the options that we've got? Well, broad option, stay or go. This is an option. The go option is something that I think President Trump's team would have to consider, because what they know is that you get into office, you start thinking about the next go at this, 2020. And surely there's people on the team that say, you have about a year or a year and a half to pull out of this. Beyond that time, it is your war now, Mr. Trump. So that's something that no matter if it was President Clinton or President Trump, of course they would be considering that. Secondly, then, if you do decide to stay, what do you do? Do you do more than you're doing right now, about the same, a little bit less? What I would offer on these options is, first of all, on the military component of this. The military right now, President Trump soon, will be looking at three options. One is stay with what we've got with right now. Conversations with General Nicholson, with most of our senior military leadership, our intelligence community would say 8,400, what we've got right now. We drop below that. We don't think we can keep the Afghan National Army and police holding the ground that they are right now. We don't think we have the capacity to have the offensive strike capability that we need against ISIS and Al-Qaeda. There's another option that's being looked at. So add to what we have maybe 500, 1,000, several thousand forces, mostly special forces, and they'll be able to give the Afghan National Army and police more capacity. And then there's a more ambitious option than that that I don't think would be considered. On the governance and development side, I don't think that we're going to be doing much more in the world of development than we're doing right now. I think, though, that I would hope that this administration would continue to make the steady state investments into education and health and other sectors that Eric had talked about, where you're not going to see any metrics in the next 6 months that show dramatic change. But in the longer term, will Afghanistan 10 years, 15, 20 years from now benefit from those strengthening of the socioeconomic sector? There's an argument to be made for that. You could have a long-term geopolitical argument. For me, it's clearly a moral argument about something we should continue to do at relatively low cost. And the final piece, then, is the diplomatic piece. It's the decisions that we have to make about this constitutionalism in Afghanistan. So the support that we give to Ashraf Ghani, are we going to make a break from this national unity government, just keep everything quiet, keep compromise going, or are we going to come to a train wreck here in 2019 when the next presidential election comes around, but there's nothing in place for the laws that need to be passed for that election to take place? That's got to be a challenge. How active do we want to be? All the time recognizing that Afghanistan is far off. We now only have 8,400 troops there. We're not spending the kind of money we were just a few years ago in Afghanistan. But Afghanistan is always going to be in the backyard of Iran and Pakistan, India, and Russia, and China. And so needing to find a way to work with them to get some kind of concert of countries that are concerned with Afghanistan, have vested interest, to at least get an agreement for non-interference. Very, very difficult to do. The United States, I think, over the next 4 years must be thinking much more in terms of not what we will do, but what do we get Afghanistan's neighbors and the other major powers to agree to do.
Just a couple of final reflections. One of the strongest arguments for continued support in Afghanistan, unfortunately, is the negative argument. What might happen if we leave? Afghans are very shrewd in thinking about, well, what is our argument for keeping up support in Afghanistan? The last time I was there in December, word on the street in Kabul is that Western governments are very concerned about ISIS and not very concerned about the Taliban in comparison. So this can lead to unintended consequences. Some Afghans are thinking, what can we do to become a frontline state against ISIS in Central Asia? So we've got to be very careful about that lead with ISIS and singular focus on ISIS. A second point on potential assistance in the future. Much rule of law assistance has been wasted, and I'm not going to defend that, but we have learned a lot in Afghanistan, and for the first time in my years working on Afghanistan, we actually have a good Chief Justice and a good Attorney General. That has not been the case in the prior years. The first Chief Justice was disastrous, and I won't regale you with stories about him. But we've got to pay attention to leadership within these institutions, too. It's just not bulk support for institutions. You've got to make sure that leaders are there. Finally, on a note of hope, American University of Afghanistan was attacked on August 24th of last year, killing students and one faculty member, a law faculty member who was teaching Islamic law at the time. There is a woman who is a polio victim who always inspired me, a law student, usually physically disabled, are hidden and forgotten in that region of the world. She was she is a third year, going on fourth year student. She had polio in one leg. In her good leg, she was praying in the mosque on campus at American University of Afghanistan, the women's mosque, when the terrorists blew in. A terrorist shot her in her good leg and then came back and shot her again. And she's in Texas now, getting surgery and getting the medical attention that she needs. And she looks forward to finishing her law degree. I tell that just because I'm inspired by stories of Afghan resilience day in and day out. They keep me going. They want to imagine a different future for themselves. I think we're done.
Thank you. Take a list, and we'll get right to it.
Carl and Eric, both of you, Eric said something about the go option. But talk a little bit more about what would happen if we go completely and the allies, the NATO allies also.
Yeah, I think, Gerhard, that if we go to the zero option, that the country would, it would return to the worst case, it would return to a civil war. The best case would be that with international donations and the United States still providing money for Afghan National Army and police salaries, as an example, that you could end up with a kind of a rump capital government in Kabul with no writ outside of the capital. Vast parts of the country suffering then from criminality, poppy trade flourishing, Taliban and international terrorist groups carving out pockets within the country, requiring us, even if we were willing to then say that that looks awfully bad, but we as a nation need to move on, it would still require, though, us to keep an eye on Afghanistan with our intelligence and with our strike forces, because we would have to go back and conduct operations periodically there.
Developmentally, the rollback on the status of women would be marked in the story that Carl tells, and the rollback in education generally. It may not return to Taliban times of 2001, but it would certainly recede.
Eric?
You've alluded to the problem of corruption. You cited it as one of three main factors challenging the legitimacy of the government. It seems, I mean, we know Ghani's a good, decent person, presumably, and understands the threat of this, but it doesn't seem to be getting better. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on what could be done by the United States and the international community in partnership with the good Afghans to, you know, try and gradually pare back the problem.
Yeah, Eric, you can take the non-security sector. On the security side, Larry, that my own thought is that we, again, to use that expression, umpires and referees, in terms of our security assistance mission that we have in the country, it's got to be more robust than it is. Currently, we have the authority. So for those that don't know the military terminology, you have your, at the national level, you've got your Ministry of Defense and your Army and Air Force headquarters. Then the first echelon down below that, out in the regions, is what would be called a corps. And then within a region of Afghanistan, where a corps has the security responsibilities, that gets into the brigade level, and then below that, battalions. Currently, our security assistance mission allows us to be robust down to the corps level. That's not very far down. And we have some authorities to go down to the brigade level. That's, in my view, Larry, that's not good enough to deal with this problem. Now, the problem, though, is that that's light support. that you, I'm thinking about, that's not changing institutions in the long term, because we were at this until 2011 and 12, and it surprised a lot of people, to include myself, how rapidly it deteriorated without the oversight, you know, big lesson of all of this. The other problem that we've got, which is, you maybe wouldn't think of it as related to the problem of corruption, but at least in the security forces, it becomes a factor, and that's the problem of agency. So for the United States, as we're there with the best of intentions, and we're training Afghan army and police and helping them equip and get ready to go off on missions, we're thinking in terms that they share our priority about going out and getting Taliban. That's what it's all about. But if you're an Afghan National Army commander, you're also thinking about your family. And you're thinking about, is this army even going to be around in a couple of years? They have a long modern history of institutions not lasting very long after foreigners leave. You also have a problem that they may not think that taking risks to go out and get Taliban is really all that important at all. Let the Americans with their special forces and our special forces go off and do that. And we've got another task here, and that's stay aligned with the political power broker and the tribe that's in our backyard. And these then can lead to problems where we're looking at appropriations of money, and we're perplexed why isn't it translating into a combat effective force. For the people that are receiving the money are nodding and saying, yes, we share your values, Taliban's our enemy, but they have a very different set of priorities and agenda, and they'll spend that money in very different ways.
On U.S. Donor assistance, I'd like to do a time and motion study of people who work in development for the U.S. government. They may spend at least 20 up to 40% of their time answering questions on various audits of funding that's going to Afghanistan. And I participated in three of these audits, just in my own personal involvement with the infrastructure. And it's there's much less seepage on foreign assistance than there used to be. It is definitely not perfect, but it's improved significantly. I think the huge current challenges now are really with the military seepage and corruption. But I'm not. I don't mean to paint a rosy story here, Larry.
I don't know your name. So the Pew Research on Pakistan says it is 78% of people in Pakistan are not favorable to the United States. So how much is it in Afghanistan? What are the factors influencing both Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Yeah, Pew doesn't do a poll in Afghanistan, but I mean, I know both countries quite well, and I think that you could flip that around with maybe up to 70% favorability of U.S. at least donor assistance to the development. I'm not talking about foreign troops here, The Afghan public was outraged when President Karzai refused to sign the bilateral security agreement with the U.S. He simply wanted to push that off to the next president. President Ghani, is one of his first acts when he came into office, was to sign the bilateral security agreement. And so I take that as a measure of, you know, Afghans, I think, have a much, much more favorable view of the U.S. than Pakistan, but that's not hard because Pakistan has one of the most negative views of the U.S. in the world.
If I could also jump back one more time to Larry after you had talked about the civilian side. It does get back to that, just how hard it is to measure what have we achieved right now. It's so easy to say we've achieved, and many Afghan critics will say, as the Russians will say, you've achieved nothing. And Eric's absolutely right. There is a pretty good attorney general who's in place right now. Larry, if that pretty good attorney general had been put in place in 2003, he would have been an absolute failure, even though he would have wanted to do well, because there were no institutions yet. So imperfect as the processes are that have been created over time, imperfect as the organizations are, for instance, the Major Crimes Task Force of Afghanistan, an Afghan-like FBI, which we had thought had, after a lot of work of the FBI there, we thought President Karzai had successfully dismantled. It resurrected itself, and this new attorney general is actually using it. So I would agree that you have a real severe problem on the security forces right now, because that's where the money is. It's salaries, it's gasoline that can be sold, and it's power. But on the civilian side, I think there are things that can be done that we should continue to lean into.
Thank you very much. I was interested in the point you made on reconciliation programs. And my first question is, to what extent do they include the Taliban? And you had mentioned that there was a sort of cottage industry that had sprung up around reconciliation programs. And I was wondering why. Is that driven by a sense of desperation, we have to try new things? Or is it driven by a sense of ripeness that now might be a time to move ahead with reconciliation? And if so, is this something that can be invested in as a policy option going forward? I was interested in your assessment on that.
Yeah, on the reconciliation side, so a little bit of history of that. I mentioned during my remarks that in 2002, my first tour of duty in Afghanistan, I wasn't an operational commander. I was helping build the Afghan National Security Forces and working in their security sector reform. But the assumption of everyone, to include the Afghans, once again, Taliban has disappeared. Now, there were some very, of course, there were sophisticated Afghan politicians who really weren't working with or weren't listening to very carefully that had said, you have a window of opportunity right now to try to bring the Taliban into the fold. That's important to understand. It's not until the insurgency becomes a real force to reckon with that we are even thinking in these terms. And then there's a great debate that goes on in Washington, D.C., both under the Bush administration, especially under the Obama administration, as we debate the surge. And there's the debate. Okay, everyone knows that as General Petraeus has famously said, the war doesn't end with the last shot being fired, it ends with the peace settlement. So there's a debate around the table about, as we put in more military combat power into Afghanistan, what should be the role of reconciliation? And those that win this debate are those that say we eventually will get to negotiations, but right now show steel. Bring these guys to their knees, and then be generous and invite them in. And the Taliban is able to hold off, but also, very importantly, they don't have the unified command that might have appealed to them to, let's think about this. So that window is missed. But it's during this period of time that there's more on the U.S. side that are questioning, shouldn't we have a reconciliation component, a more robust one? Richard Holbrooke, who tries to lead this effort, but Richard is then taking a secondary position to the military view that we need a couple of years of getting effects with these 100,000 troops that we've got in the country. And you have more skepticism starting to appear among the Afghan leadership, but at the same time, the President Karzai is now realizing, well, we really do need reconciliation. The trust factor with the United States has evaporated. It's just blown up after the 2009 election. So he doesn't trust the United States to get heavily engaged in a reconciliation process. So he's going in his direction. You have the Europeans that believe this is important, and they start off in their own direction. So that's the background of what happened here, and why wasn't this done in more coherent method. There's a Taliban factor, there's our own strategy, and there's the mistrust with Karzai, and then Eric's already explained, I think, on the Pakistan side, their various views of this. The Pakistani view, I guess you could sum it up, being that back in, certainly at the height of our surge, where they're skeptical that the United States has got the staying power to see this through, well, were they right? We've got 8,400 troops. When they were skeptical, we had 100,000 troops. And the security situation is getting worse. So their strategy is one where you think, well, we have got to keep a hedge because the Americans are going to leave at some point. The country's going to deteriorate. And then Iran's going to be mucking around. The Russians are going to be there. The Indians are going to be there. And so we're not that strong a nation. And what we'll do is we'll keep the Taliban option alive. That's our influence in deteriorating Afghanistan. But then if you'd have the other view to the Pakistan, you say, well, look, actually, we got this crystal ball, General Sharif or General Kiani, and we can tell you the Americans are actually going to achieve their objectives. Afghanistan's going to be on the road to Denmark one day. And then he would say, and that's even more reason to keep the Afghan Taliban alive, because that Afghanistan will be allied with India.
Last question here, and then anybody with remaining questions can come up and see our speakers afterwards. Go for it.
Thank you, gentlemen. So talking about ISIS, and I know recognizing, looking at the map, they're a relatively isolated area in Afghanistan. Does the Afghan government kind of see them as a qualitatively different threat than the Taliban? And then how is that affecting the hold and bite kind of strategy that they're taking on?
That's a good question. I actually am not sure that I know the answer to it. I know the angle of using ISIS as a way to continue to get funding to Afghanistan, but you're right, ISIS is present in an isolated area. They tend to have some vicious tactics that the Taliban find more vicious than they would contemplate. So I simply don't have the intelligence access either to say it. But it's a limited number. It hasn't grown exponentially over time. But I don't know the extent to which the government of Afghanistan views ISIS as a threat. I suspect not much yet.
I would agree. There's foreign fighters that are coming into ISIS. It's something that we've got an eye on. But the Afghan government, I don't want to be too cynical about this, but the Afghan government, you know that the power brokers from 2001, 2002 inside of Afghanistan got very adept in identifying their domestic enemies as Taliban. And that led to U.S. responses, and so it would be understandable, I think, that if Ashraf Ghani and his leaders and the army of Afghanistan want to exaggerate an ISIS threat, which is there and it's real and it's growing, that would be understandable. In fact, I will show you a Doonesbury cartoon. I do this with a bit of reluctance here, because to make humor of what has been a very tragic war is something to be careful of. But to this point, so it's a Doonesbury cartoon, and this is a CIA operative with a warlord in Afghanistan, and the CIA operative says, "So what have you got for me? Drug lord, a major player." And then this warlord says, "He's challenging my authority here, but I can't touch him. He's got connections in Kabul." And the CIA operative says, "Where's he at?" And he's told, "That gray house over there, just beyond the mosque." And then you have him on an iPad, click, click, click. And then you hear an explosion. And the CIA operative saying, "What else you got?" And he says, I don't get it. How come you guys are losing?"
That's brilliant.
And on that note, join me in thanking Carl Eckenberg and Carl.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.